You're listening to Career Chat's Executive Insights, brought to you by Page Executive.
Okay, hello and welcome to the next in series of the Page Executive Executive Career Chat, where we're talking to some of the leaders that we get to work with in the course of our day-to-day operations. I'm your host for today, John Holton. I'm associate partner for Page Executive CFO practice in the north of England. And really pleased today to be joined by Ray Stenton. Ray is managing partner of North Edge Capital, who are one of the largest and most active private equity investors in the north of England. Welcome, Ray.
Thanks, John. Good to see you.
Yeah, you too. I'll start with an obvious one then, or an easy one, Ray, I guess. So managing partner of North Edge Capital, you're having a beer on holiday and you meet a stranger and someone says, "Hi, you're called Ray, what is it you do?" What do you say?
Good question. Fund manager, I would probably start off with, but then try and get into, you know, I work with really interesting businesses, trying to help them grow, add value. Then hopefully, you know, through that investment, make a return for all the people involved. So, I don't try and overcomplicate it. We buy and sell businesses ultimately.
it's a fair assessment, I think, isn't it? Yeah. But it's, and look, today, so we want to understand a bit about your story. And as you say, you're now buying and selling businesses for a living. But if we go back to the beginning, where did you kind of start? Were you always planning on doing that, Ray, or how did that all come about?
I think I always had an interest in business. I took a particular shine to economics when I was at school, and I had a very good economics teacher, so he had an influence on me. So I just had a general broader interest in the economy and what made businesses tick and what made successful businesses. And then I just took that into my degree. So I did a degree in economics, business economics, and then sort of fell into accountancy really as a natural route into broader business, essentially.
It's interesting you say there, though, about sort of that economics teacher being sort of a part of the interest in business and so on, because sort of your family background and so on, that wasn't present in sort of your parents and so on.
No, I mean, my father was an engineer. My mum was a school teacher. I mean, they worked hard. So I think the biggest thing I learned from them was sort of the drive to put the effort in, really. But there wasn't a sort of entrepreneurial spirit in the family as such.
When did that kind of, can you pinpoint a point then early on when that kind of happened for you?
I think I always wanted to make money. That was a driver for me. Really through my school years.
So did you do things at school that were kind of entrepreneurial? Were you selling stuff in the playgrounds or whatever? Like,
I haven't got the Alan Sugar story, but you know, I used to work quite hard. I used to take lots of part-time jobs. We did various school projects where, you know, there was entrepreneurial challenges and things. But I wouldn't say it was setting up a tuck shop every break and trying to make a turn there. It was more just general interest and just wanting to make my own way, making a bit of money myself.
Didn't you want to be in a band, though?
Oh, yeah.
Would that have been the first option before buying and selling businesses for a living?
I always had a passion for music. I learned to play the guitar and always fancied myself as a bit of a rock star, but never quite made that. And I was a DJ as well. So I used to DJ. I suppose that was a bit, you know, I made a bit of money out of that. I used to DJ through university and used to DJ at a few clubs in Manchester in the early 90s. But you used to spend all your money on records those days. So you never really made a living out of it.
Who were your musical influences? What sort of band were you going to be in? Tell us a bit about that, Ray, and why it failed. You know.
Well, Jam, Paul Weller was a big influence, I think. You know, yeah. A lot of the mod stuff, the Who, the Kinks, had a real interest in all of that. Any real sort of rock guitar based music, I used to enjoy. And then I moved into dance music through DJing and the like, so quite varied. And it was just, we had a school band, it was cool to be in the band. We never really took it that seriously. We didn't really practice. We thought we'd just rock up and, you know, all the girls would be swooning after us, and it didn't quite work out that way.
It's the only reason anyone learns a musical instrument, right? It's basically being a rock band in order exactly. to be cool and attract the opposite sex. Yeah, fair enough. I imagine as well, if you were Manchester that kind of time, for another time, there's some interesting stories and things that you saw and perhaps were part of, Ray, that there's quite a few tales to tell, I'd imagine.
I think it was quite a lively time, I think, being a student in 19... So I came to Manchester in 1990. Mm. So it was a pretty interesting time to be going out around Manchester. Obviously, the Hacienda was a big part of where you spent some of your nights. There was lots of interesting bands around as well. So, yeah, there was a few stories.
We spoke a little bit before, and you kind of said... It sounds like you had a lot of fun there, but at the same time, obviously, you were embarking on the first steps of what's turned into a very successful career in business. Was there a point where you sort of, I mean, not that you didn't take it seriously then, but then you really started to go, right, I need to get on here because I'm not going to be Paul Weller, you know?
Yeah, well, I think doing your chartered exams really gives you a bit of a kick, a dose of reality, should I say. You know, I was always able to sort of sail through exams up until then. So university was relatively easy. I should have pushed myself harder. I got a 2-1, should have got a first, but I enjoyed myself during those 3 years. Then you get thrown into your chartered accountancy exams with, you know, a lot of very bright people. Mm. And, you know, half of the people don't get through those exams, and you've got to really work at them. So that was at the point where, you know, some of my friends were off enjoying themselves and I would be doing exams on a Saturday morning and, you know, having to study after you did a full day's work as well. So that was really the point where it was time to get my head down, because there's a lot of work to get through and qualify in your chartered accountancy exams. And you're starting your career as well, so it's quite a difficult balance. So your social life does definitely take a backseat and you have to prioritise things.
Did you ever kind of, not to talk in a bit of a cliche around it, but did you ever, you know, you're a lad from the Northeast who was into, you know, being in a band and being a DJ and so on and so forth, and then doing a chartered accountancy exam. It's, at that time, that's probably not the sort of traditional route where somebody would come through to get into that world. Did you always kind of recognise or see yourself as kind of slightly different to that world? And has that then sort of, you know, sort of carried on with how you've been in your career at all?
Yeah, definitely. I did look and act differently to a lot of people in that group, in that cohort. And I always thought it gave me a bit of an advantage when, so I started in audit, and I always thought I could connect better with people. I thought, you know, I had a more, I won't say down to earth, but I had a more approachable personality. I was able to talk to people on their level. And, you know, when you start auditing, all right, you get exposure to the finance director and the financial controller and some quite senior people. But the majority of your time in your first couple of years, you're working with the payroll clerk or the debtor's ledger clerk or, you know, who aren't qualified accountants. And to get the best out of them, you have to connect with them. So I think I really did use that to my advantage, my personality, to be able to connect with people and really get information out of them. On a more human level. So I do think it gave me a bit of a bit of an advantage, and I've always used that through my career. I think, you know, fundamentally, the more you do work with different businesses and different people, you know, you fundamentally get it's all about the people. Mm. It's not about the business model per se. It's about the people who are driving the business and how they work together. And I've always had a real interest in that side of business, really.
Did you feel then at all that you ever had to adapt sort of who you were? And you, one of the questions that actually I've asked a few of your colleagues as to what they might want to ask, and one of them was whether you bring the real Ray Stenson into work, and if that's difficult. But have you always kind of brought the real Ray Stenson in, or has that real Ray Stenson adapted over time and changed? Or
I think I've always been authentic. I wear my heart on my sleeve. I think that's probably been one of my strengths, really. I think as you get in a more senior leadership position, you do have to adapt a bit. You know, you can't be everyone's best friend and, you know, be out there sort of joking and being part of the team always. There's got to be a little bit of distance sometimes. But I think you've got to be authentic as a leader. You can't be anything but, otherwise you get found out. So I wouldn't say I've fundamentally adapted. I've managed to maybe sort of listen more, maybe not try and lead from the front as much, maybe try and give people more space to develop, and take a real keen interest in working with people to develop them. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you're sort of emerging through your career early on, you're very focused on yourself and how you develop and how you prove yourself. And then I think as you develop into a more senior leadership position, you definitely have to adapt to thinking more broadly about how you're going to develop your people.
Was there a point in your career where, you talk about that sort of senior leadership, was there a point in your career where you recognised you were a leader?
Actually, it's a good question. You don't think of yourself as a leader. I think as being responsible for our own business, you know, when we set up and did North Edge when we all left LDC, I think that was the real change. Because in LDC, you were part of a large organisation. You were essentially an employee. You were part of a big machine. And obviously, you had your own teams to manage. And you had a senior position in the organisation, but you were part of a much bigger piece. I think when we decided to do this ourselves, that was when I really thought, wow, you know, we've got some responsibility here. We're not just responsible for ourselves, but, you know, the team that we're bringing through, our employees, our investors, and if we want to build this into something that is going to be sustainable and lives beyond us, then, you know, we do need to lead. We do need to develop our team. I think that was the real point for me when we set up North Edge. You know, there's a real recognition there around how things had changed.
And did you sort of set out, what did you say when you sort of starting that up? And I know you joined very early, obviously, on in your journey with North Edge. And did you set out a particular kind of charter or a plan of this is how it's going to be as a business, or was it more just, you know, this is how we want to operate in general, or how do you kind of, I'd almost measure that as well, I guess.
Yeah, well, we had a very clear view on what the culture and values and behaviours were going to be in the business. We'd seen lots of great stuff at LDC. It was a great business for us. And there was bits that we you know, weren't as great as ever in any large organisation. So I think we came to North Edge with a very clear vision on creating a culture of ownership, of responsibility, of doing things in the right way, which is not always what private equity would be perceived as doing. Being very responsible in terms of the relationships we have, being very communicative, being very transparent. So just doing things in the right way, and creating that mindset of ownership and the responsibility that comes with it. That was the vision for North Edge, and I think we have achieved that. And you've got to still work very hard to continue it, but that was what the foundations of the business were built on.
Mm. Is that, and I'm sure it has, and again, it's one of the questions that's come from one of your colleagues around what, as North Edge has grown, what's been the best change that you've made in the culture and behaviours as it's developed that's had the most positive impact on the organisation?
I think we've done a lot on, so we've taken the whole of the business, every one of the team through a programme called Living Leader, which has been quite a significant investment for us. And I think that's been a real statement to the business around how serious we are about developing them. You know, we want for people to act like owners. We've got to create an environment for them where they feel safe taking the responsibility that an owner needs to take. So I think that's been a big change for us. And that's gone from all of the professional staff right through to the support staff. And I think everyone's embraced it, and it gives people almost a toolkit and reference set of, you know, how you can step up and take responsibility. We've done a lot more on communication. So when we were small and there was five of us, it was very easy to make decisions and have clarity on what we were trying to achieve. As we've built out to three officers and now have 35 staff, you have to work quite hard on communication. So I do regular updates and blogs. We have regular feedback sessions. We've done a lot on employee feedback and then sharing the results with people and then having specific actions to address things and then monitoring progress year on year. I think the pandemic helped as well on bringing people together and really, really making us up our game on communication. I think bringing more diversity of talent into the business as well. Unsurprisingly, when we started, there was four or five of us and we all looked very similar. And we just recruited in a very similar vein. And as we've grown, we've recognised that has significant limitations. So bringing people like, you know, Nicola in, Lucy, Jordana, Manny, and then giving them a voice very early. So Nick leads our diversity and inclusion programme. Lucy leads our business transformation and she regularly presents to the partner group. I think people can see that, you know, we want them to take responsibility and have a voice, and we're giving people a voice and we listen to that. So probably a long-winded answer, but there's lots of things that have come together, I think, over the last... I think we've grown up as a business. You know, we started, there was four or five of us. We've grown quite quickly in the 10 years we've been managing funds. And I think the last 5 years, we've really invested in that people side of the business, which we didn't necessarily do in the first 5 years.
Mm-hmm. And is that... Is that kind of... adapted your natural leadership style as well through developing the business in that way? Is that sort of altered how you are normally, or are you
a little bit, because I my style was very much, I always thought I had to lead from the front. I'd be first in the office, last out. I set fairly high standards and be fairly demanding and try and drive from the front. I think I've learned to maybe listen more, do less talking. Let people lead meetings more, let people have their voice and drive decisions and take responsibility for that, rather than almost me feeling as though I had to be there leading that. I had a period out of the business through illness, and that really, to be honest, was probably very good for me, because, you know, the business had to get on and adapt, and I've not tried to interfere and step back in too much when on my return.
And that's something I want to come on to very shortly, Ray, around that aspect of recent times. It's interesting to talk about, I suppose, the things you've learned and so on. Has there been a lot of success in the North Edge, obviously? Again, one of the questions that sort of posed by one of your colleagues, is there something you look back on as a mistake or an opportunity missed that has influenced things as well that you've learned from?
Oh yeah, we've made lots of mistakes.
is there anything that sticks out?
I think we've made some wrong people decisions, but that will always be the case. You're never going to get the people decisions right, and we're probably, with hindsight, too slow to react to those. We probably were over ambitious on some of the complexity we took on some deals early on, but that's just investment judgment. As an investor, you never know whether you make the right investment decision or not. So there's always an element of judgment and risk attached to what we do. I think we were a bunch of hugely ambitious deal doers, and we didn't understand how that translated to being a disciplined fund manager. I think you only learn that as you mature as a business. So, coming from LDC, we were very much a balance sheet investor and very hungry deal doers, and we found the reasons to do all the deals. I think you need, as a fund manager, you need to think about portfolio construct a lot more, the cyclical aspects of the investments you're making and how that influences the investment decisions you make in each fund. And you need to look at fund performance a lot more than individual company performance as well. And that's something we've learned as we've evolved as in a business. But yeah, one of the reasons I love what we do, you never stop learning. It's about the people fundamentally. And, I think we've learned our lessons. We've got a real culture of learning from the good and the bad as well. We don't just focus on the mistakes we've made. We focus on the successes we've had as well, and sharing learning across the organisation. I think that's been a good thing that we've developed over the 10 years we've been in operation.
I won't ask for deals that perhaps you have done that you wish you hadn't. That's unfair. But are there deals that you didn't do that you wish you had? Are there any that stick out that you've passed on and you think really should have gone for that one?
There will always be those instances. To be honest, I'm not going to name any names. As I say, it's always judgment. And there's always things where you look back and think, I should have done that differently. We could have done this. And it's a competitive market, and you've got to be really on your game to win things. You can't take things for granted. Maybe there's been the odd example where we thought we'd won something, and with hindsight, we probably could have put a bit more effort in. But that'll always be the case. I think on the whole, we're pleased with the vast majority of things we've done. There are things with hindsight, we shouldn't have done. But every private equity fund will have those examples. I think, making sure you minimise your losses and maximise your winners is something that's important as a fund manager. And I think we're getting better at that. Probably things with hindsight we've sold too early, but that's wonderful with hindsight. There's probably things that we've held on to too long. So they'll always be, when you look back, decisions that you could have made slightly differently, I think.
Going back to your leadership and obviously you alluded to there the period of time you had out of the business recently, and how that's sort of affected your style and how differently perhaps you are as you've come back into the business. I just want to tell us that story, Ray.
It was June last year, actually end of June last year. Really strange period of time. It came very quickly. Got up one morning, my legs felt weak. Didn't think anything of it. Thought it was just overexertion in the gym.
You were quite a bit of a weightlifter, weren't you?
Well, I used to enjoy weights, yeah. And I'd just done my best ever deadlift and best ever bench press. So I was there. I was feeling pretty chuffed with myself.
Give us the numbers, Ray. You can't trail that and not tell us.
It was 145 and these were 10 reps, not one rep max, 145 okay, yeah. kilos on deadlift.
I love that you had to get that in. Just because this isn't my best. This is 10. Yeah, okay.
145 kilos on deadlifts and 85 kilos on the bench press, which was I was pretty pleased with. So I got up the next day, legs were weak, got up the following day. So this was a Saturday, got up to Sunday. Arms were pretty weak and just didn't feel right. And got up on the Monday and sort of struggled to get down the stairs. So I went to A&E, got seen by lots of people. And by the Monday night, I was admitted into the emergency assessment unit. And by Monday night, I couldn't get out of bed. And then the Tuesday, I was pretty much sort of bed bound. I didn't have any strength in my legs or my arms to get out of bed. So I ran lots of tests. And then by the Wednesday, they diagnosed Guillain-Barré syndrome, which I hadn't heard of, which is essentially an autoimmune disease. So your brain and your immune system mistakenly attacks your nervous system instead of the infection in your body. It's very rare. I think it's about 1 in a million chance of occurrence. Fatality rate's about 10%. And long-term impact about 20%. What essentially happened was within the space of that week, I went from walking into A&E to being paralysed from the neck down, which was pretty scary. And then by the end of the week, my breathing was pretty restricted as well, so I was taken into intensive care. Now, luckily, Salford's a great neuro hospital, so they diagnosed it quickly and started to treat me. Which slows down the progression of the paralysis. And when it gets scary is when it goes into your head and your breathing stops. So that's why I was transferred to intensive care. The treatment started working actually as I went into intensive care. So I didn't need ventilating, which was good. I was just on oxygen. So intensive care for a week, breathing stabilized, started to improve, and then was transferred out of intensive care into the acute neurological unit, where I spent the next 3 months. And pretty much I was paralyzed from the neck down, couldn't do anything for myself. And obviously it was a period of time when COVID restrictions were still in place, so couldn't have any visitors, which was pretty tough. And then after 3 months, I started to steadily improve, still no movement really. And I was transferred to a rehabilitation unit in Trafford, where I spent another 3 months. So overall, I was in hospital for 6 months, and probably 5 of those 6 months, I was paralysed from the neck down.
What? I mean, it's an unbelievable thing to have gone through, especially for somebody that's, you know, say very active and, you know, very active in business as well. And obviously, your mind's always very active. What were you thinking as you were laid there, not seeing people, not, you know, not able to meet?
I think you get a sense of perspective when you're in that position. The main thing that sort of kept me going, I think, was the specialist who came around the first week said, look, you're one of the lucky ones in here. You've got a 80% chance of recovery, and most of the people in this neuro unit haven't. So you're going to be with us a long while, but keeps a sense of perspective. So from that moment, I focused on, well, I'm going to be in that 80%. You know, I'm not in the 20% that don't recover, and I'm going to get better. So that sort of kept a real sense of balance, to be honest, because there was lots of really poorly people in that neuro ward who, you know, didn't have much to keep going for, whereas I did. So that kept me going. And I just, I'm fairly determined. I'm fairly driven. I'm fairly good at keeping a focus. So obviously there was moments of doubt and there was moments of worry, but I sort of just got on with it. So that was my whole mantra, really. Just, it is what it is, and you need to focus on how you're going to get better.
How, I mean, it's a very, I suppose, yeah, single mind in a very positive way of looking at it. How, without prying, how did your family deal with it?
Yeah, I think it was pretty tough for my wife and two kids. My eldest daughter was brilliant, Ella. my youngest daughter struggled with it quite a lot. So, you know, it was quite scary for her. And Claire, you know, Claire got lots of support. So there was lots of family to help and support. And the nurses would hold my iPhone every day so I could at least sort of connect every day. I couldn't hold a phone up, obviously.
Yeah.
But I was speaking to Claire every day. So, and she knows what I'm like. You know, so I think she took a lot of comfort in, you know, I'm determined and I would get better. But yeah, it was very hard for them, I think, very hard.
And how's the recovery been then, Ray? What was kind of the story as you came out of hospital?
Yeah, it's pretty good. I came out week before Christmas, so I was in hospital exactly 6 months and 72 days. I was determined to get out for Christmas, so I was in a wheelchair, no real mobility. I just started taking my first, so I'd learned how to sit up, I'd learned how to transfer myself out of a bed into a wheelchair, and I'd just started taking my first steps, although they weren't unaided. So we set up a bed in a hospital bed in the downstairs room. So again, fortunate that I had a house which could accommodate that. Many people aren't. Unfortunate that I had my wife and my eldest daughter to help me. So that was really how I was able to get out. And I just focused on small steps from there on in. So lots of physio. And it just takes time for your nervous system to repair itself. That's the biggest thing with this disease. That's 12 to 24 months recovery. So just threw myself into physio, really. And it's gone great. I'm now up and walking, pretty mobile, hands pretty flexible. You know, I haven't got the mobility I used to have, but if someone said this is as good as it gets, I'd take it every day of the week. I'm back at work. I was pretty much back at work from January onwards. As soon as I could lift a phone up and iPad and start using that, I was and I needed that mental stimulation anyway. And to be honest, I was doing that when I was in hospital. I used to get my iPad set up on a morning when I was in the rehab unit, and I was fairly communicative with work during that period as well. So I just threw myself into it, and it's gone really well, so I'm really pleased.
Were you, through that recovery, have you been setting sort of small goals to reach, or how have you kind of approached that side of things? Because it sounds like, as you say, it's going to be quite a long process. So.
Yeah, so first bit was to walk outside. Done that. I managed to do that in March, because it's quite different from walking inside to out with the noise and the distraction and the unevenness of floors. Then it was to walk a mile. Then it was to walk 2 miles. Then it was to walk 3. Managed to achieve that in March, and now it's some more functional things around being able to run on a treadmill for 5 minutes, which I've managed to do. Starting on weights again, so I'm lifting about a third of what I could do. So the target now is to get to a half by the end of summer, and then, you know, hopefully get back to where I was by next year. So it's just little things like that, really.
Yeah. And obviously you're not through all of that recovery, not through it all, but you're obviously through the worst of it now, Ray, which is great. Reflecting on that, and you started to talk about it a little bit before, reflecting on that, how do you view that period in your life now?
Strange period. It almost feels as though I didn't miss out on too much, because the world was a bit crazy as well. So, everyone was suffering.
Yeah, you planned it well. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
everyone was suffering from lockdown and their own issues. So I think it was a period of time which was probably good for me to have the opportunity to reflect, think about what's important, because you're so consumed with family life and work, and understand and recognize the importance of the little things. You know, the importance of your family is unbelievable, and you never take that for granted, but it really, really brings it home when you've got, you know, a period like that, and your friends and your colleagues. Obviously don't take anything for granted.
Has that been the biggest thing that's come out of it then, and maybe linking it back to work and so on? You sort of, I know you spoke a little bit about that before, but as to how you're approaching work and and your leadership style as well. Just talk around that kind of,
yeah,
that's affected things.
I mean, I used to be a big worrier, and I don't think you can do this job without worrying, because the responsibility of investing other people's money is huge. So we take that very, very seriously. I think the biggest thing I've learned is not to worry about the little things. That's probably been my biggest difference in sort of mentality since coming out of hospital, and focus on the things you can influence. And then I've taken that into work. Not to get involved in the little things, let people find their way through that. But really help people on the bigger decisions that are going to make a difference. Because the only way you learn is through making your own decisions and your own experience and your own mistakes. So obviously we're not encouraging mistakes at all, but we want to create a safe environment for our people to learn and support them. And to do that, you've got to give them their voice and you've got to give them responsibility. So, I don't worry about the little things as much. That would be my biggest thing.
Has it changed your, I don't necessarily give away too much, you might not want to, but has it changed long-term aspirations or anything like that, Ray? As to how you think about your career and what you want to do in it? Or?
Not really, no. I think what it taught me being not in the thick of things for six months was, I'm definitely not ready to retire. I need that stimulation. I need that challenge. I need to be around talented, like-minded people who are challenging each other. I really enjoy that mental stimulation. So I'm only 49. I'm nowhere near ready to retire, and that really did reinforce it. I want to build. I love what we do. I want to build a phenomenal business at North Edge along with my other partners and colleagues, and have something that endures. And at the right time, people will tell me when they don't need me and I'm not to be involved, and that'll be the right point to step off. But we've got so much more we want to do at North Edge. It's made me more determined to make this the success it should be and will be.
What does that look like? What is success at North Edge for you?
Really good returns, clearly, because that keeps our stakeholders happy.
Keeps the offices open, yeah.
Really enthused and encouraged colleagues and employees who get the chance to develop their careers and hopefully stay with us for a very, very long time. Taking our responsibility in the community really seriously, so doing things to give back as well. That is something I had massively underappreciated, the value of the NHS, because I've never ever used it. I've never had a day in hospital in my life, or never really went to the GP. And the sacrifices those people make are phenomenal, and it's hugely underfunded and got loads of issues around staff as well.
Did some fundraising, I think, didn't you?
Yeah, we did a march in March, which was a few of the team's idea, actually. And it was twofold. One, to do something good for charity, but two, really, the principle was to get our people out whilst we were still in lockdown. It was really tough being stuck at your desk every day. So we encouraged people to get out during the day to do a walk or a ride or a run. And we did phenomenal collectively. I think we did over 3,000 miles in March, 30 of us. And we raised close to £30,000, and we raised that on behalf of the Trafford rehab unit that I was in. Because one thing I was surprised at when I was in there, how poor the facilities were in terms of gyms. So, very limited facilities, and right, that did surprise me. So they've been delighted with what we've done there, and they're going to spend all of that money on really upgrading the gym equipment they have to give people a far better chance in their recovery.
Fantastic stuff. I just wanted to come to one thing, and I asked a couple of your colleagues to describe you in three words.
This is scary.
So I'm interested first, what three words would you use to describe yourself, right? And we'll see whether there's any correlation.
Driven. I think that would definitely be top of my list. I think fair. I would like to think people would think of me as a very fair person. Don't take myself too seriously. I think I'm quite good company at all. And I do care a lot. I do care about what we do and the way we do it. I suppose that comes back to fairness, really. So that's maybe four words, is it?
Maybe, I think it is four, yeah, yeah.
Always got to get another one in.
One of them said can't count, which was good. Yeah. No, to be fair, so yeah, I think driven was in there. Loyal, demanding, commercial, and the one that both of the people we came back said was passionate, which I think that sort of caring about what you do definitely comes across. I don't think you were far off there. That was good. Good to know your staff think you're demanding as well. I mean, that's what you
in
want.
In the right way. In the
right way. Well, you know, I didn't ask, but they reckon you'd got access to their emails, so they were being quite coy. Final question. I know you're a big Sunderland fan. Before we get on to that, are there somebody who's sort of been physically active? And didn't you do some boxing before? Is that right? Did you do?
So I did a white collar boxing event. It was the first time they did it in Manchester.
Yeah.
It was for, I think it was for Maggie's, was it? I can't remember which charity it was for, actually, but we raised a hell of a lot of money. And it was a very, very well organised event. I fought my former mentor and boss, Pat Loftus. I mean, Pat's been a great influence on my career. Mm-hmm. When I originally moved into county, I joined BDO, and then we quickly got taken over by Arthur Anderson. And Pat was a huge influence in all of that. And then Pat went on to have a great career at Anderson's and Deloitte. We both got asked to do it, and we both said we'd only do it if we could fight each other. So that was the request we had. And Pat's super competitive, the most competitive guy you'll meet. He's brilliant at everything, sport-wise. So I knew he'd take it seriously, and he knew I'd take it seriously, but we've got huge respect for each other. He's a phenomenal guy. And he's had a huge influence on lots of people's careers in the Northwest and beyond. He takes a real interest in people. Probably the biggest influence on my career, really. Mm-hmm. One of them. We did it. We took it very seriously. I obviously had age on my side. Pat's a few years older than me. Thankfully I managed to win.
You've never been able to live it down if you're lost, right? Absolutely not. Have you got any, I mean, you've spoken about sort of, you know, lifting weights again and so on. Have you got beyond kind of getting back to where you are? Are you able to think about physical goals and challenges and things like that beyond sort of getting back to where you were before? Or?
Yeah, so in January I've done a marathon, I've done road coast to coast, I've done Race the Sun. I've done quite a few challenges. Mm. I've never done a triathlon, so yeah, I'd love to have the capacity to be able to do that. I need to assess probably after summer whether that's realistic or not, but you know, next year, if I could do a triathlon, that would be something I'd strive towards. I just don't know whether I'll get my running ability back. That's going to be the biggest challenge.
Yeah. Final question then, right? I know you're a big Sunderland fan. So, and you might take ages thinking about this, but you might not. You're going to be playing the Sunderland all-time five-a-side team. Who are the other four players that you're having in?
Well, Kevin Phillips is in.
Obviously, up front, yeah.
Our greatest ever goal scorer. Kevin Ball in midfield. He's such a battler, and he's got such a passion for Sunderland. Who's in goal? Thomas Sorensen probably in goal. He was a great keeper. And then Niall Quinn was a great player as well, but I don't know whether he'll be any good in five-a-side, would he? He's a bit too tall. Don't know. Ian Porterfield. Scored the winning goal at in the 73 final. Our only ever success apart from 37.
That's right, yeah. Beating my beloved Leeds United, as I recall.
I've got a great story about the current Sunderland manager, actually. It was fantastic. March last year, I get a phone call, unnamed number. It was about 7 at night. I pick it up and the guy near there goes, "It's Lee Johnson here, Sunderland manager." And I thought it was one of my mates winding me up.
Winding you up.
I was like, "Yeah, of course it is." I mean, no, seriously, it is. I just wanted to get in touch with you. I'd heard you'd had Guillain-Barre syndrome and are recovering from it. And just to let you know, my dad did. My dad had the same. And he's made a full recovery now. So you just need to stick in, you know, because, you know, you can make a proper recovery from this. And it was fantastic, you know, that he took his time out to call me. And we ended up having a chat for half an hour about Sunderland and the good and the bad.
Tell him how to be a leader and how to manage it. Yeah.
But I just thought that was a great story. The power of, you know, people connecting with each other and taking an interest in people. And I'll never forget that. It was great.
Nice touch. The very last thing. And look, thank you ever so much for this race. It's been brilliant. And it came about, as you know, through us interviewing Nick McQuaid, who works for you as well, and she recommended and suggested that you would be a fantastic subject for interview. So, forward to you now. Who should we be interviewing next in this series?
Yeah, I just had a quick think about this before we came on. I think there's a business we back called Utility Group, led by a chap called Matt Hurst, Chorley lad. Real down-to-earth guy. We backed it probably in 2015, was it? I can't remember, but around that time. I think we bought it for 18 million. It was a buyout of a failing PLC. This was a really interesting part of the part of the group, where all the value was. And Matt and Drew were the two guys at the time who had a vision for the business. It does software solutions for the energy industry. And smart meters was going to have a huge impact on data flows and software and interoperability. And they had a vision of how they could join all that up together. And we backed them. And we subsequently sold the business 3 years later for 100 million. And it was sold to a US PE fund that was doing a global roll-up. So Matt went with the business. And he subsequently become global CEO of that group. So a guy 5 years ago that was trying to cobble together a buyout of a local business based in Chorley that we were trying to raise raise 18 million quid for, you know, is now in charge of a global business that, I don't know, will it be worth $1 billion in a few years? Potentially could be. So I think he would be an interesting chap to have a chat with. I haven't asked him or warned him or anything, but I'm sure Matt wouldn't mind giving you half an hour of his time to tell you his story.
That'd be fantastic. Well, look, we'll pick up around that later on. But yeah, he sounds like a great guy to speak to as well. Well, look, thank you very much, Ray. Pleasure speaking to you. Been great to hear your story and all the best with the recovery. And all the best with North Edge in the future as well, and hope to speak to you again soon.
Thank you. Really enjoyed it.
No worries. Take care.
Thanks, John.
To hear more from our guests, including their extraordinary careers and expert advice, make sure you subscribe to the Career Chats podcast, available on Audioboom, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify, to get the episodes as soon as they drop.